lift the glass and make as though to take it out. "If you touch that sword, I will use it to slice off your fingers, roast them, and feed them to Celine," the Belladonna informed her, not looking up from the glass she had dropped the blade into. Beside her, the wolf looked up from the bone it had been gnawing and gave a snort of confirmation. Nicholas looked away quickly, attempting not to identify it as a human femur. "What sword is that?" Sophia asked, still eyeing it.
"Arthur's Caliburn," the Belladonna said.
"Excalibur?"
Nicholas couldn't stop his brows from rising. A legendary sword, one that didn't exist, so far as he knew.
"How has someone not bought this off you?" Sophia asked. "Ironwood would probably love to use it to behead his most hated enemies. His murders could use a little poetry."
The Belladonna's veil rustled and crimped, as if she'd smiled at the word Ironwood. "She knows who we are," Nicholas thought with a growing sense of unease.
"One of my scavengers fished it out of a filthy lake for me," the Belladonna said. "However, I've never been able to prove the provenance of the object to your Grandmaster's standards. And so it remains. Until it one day needs to be found. No, beastie. Take that thought of stealing it from your mind."
Sophia's hand immediately lowered.
"I'd hate for you to join my cadre of thieves."
Without lifting her eyes from Sophia, the Belladonna pointed to a large, drooping net hanging from the ceiling. It was filled with human skulls, all boiled and polished as smoothly as pearls from the sea. At the sight of it, Sophia scowled and moved on to examine the next case, which contained a line of 8 bejeweled and gold-trimmed eggs of various sizes.
"Imperial Fabergé eggs, lately of Russia," the Belladonna said,
pulling a grape from a nearby plate of them and popping it into her mouth.
"I'm willing to bargain, if they're of interest. It's become damned difficult to auction them away, with the instability of that period."
Instability? Nicholas seized upon the word, storing the information away. Where there was instability, there were likely changes to the timeline.
"Maybe I should have let you go first,"
Sophia muttered to Nicholas, greedily eyeing a bowl of pristine apples that seemed oddly out of place.
"I could be eating a fresh pork dinner right now."
"That does sound rather appealing, I must say," the Belladonna said,
tossing a grape to the wolf, who snapped it out of the air. The animal gave a curious sniff in Sophia's direction, but lowered its head and resumed its watch over them.
"There's King John's treasure in the corner over there, next to Cromwell's head, and a panel of the Bayeux tapestry, if you've yet to finish wasting my time."
At her interested hum, Nicholas grabbed the scruff of Sophia's neck, cutting off her path.
"We've business here, mind you."
"Over Cromwell's head, though,"
Sophia said pitifully, as if this might convince him. He stepped forward, winding through the rows of shelves that separated them from the desk. Sophia followed reluctantly, shaking off Nicholas's grip. To his complete and utter lack of surprise, there were no chairs for them to sit in. They presented themselves to the Belladonna like a mustering militia.
"Now," the woman said, "tell me what it is Ironwood seeks, and I shall tell you my fee."
Sophia made a noise of disgust.
"We're not here on the old man's business."
The woman settled back in her chair.
"Are you not Sophia Elizabeth Ironwood, born in July of 1904? Lovingly..."
The world was impaled with sarcasm.
"Pulled from St. Mary's Orphanage in 1910, after you were caught pickpocketing for the third time."
Sophia put her hands on her hips and said,
"Well, they didn't catch me the other hundreds of times. 3 is hardly a bad score."
Nicholas couldn't be sure why the other woman had said it, other than to awe them with her knowledge, or disarm Sophia. Rescued. Orphanage. Pickpocketing. Christ.
Julian had vaguely mentioned to him in passing that Sophia had not had a lady's upbringing, until Ironwood brought her into the family. But this, it went beyond humble origins. And, as he himself knew, when you were forced to learn survival as a child, the instinct became etched into your soul. The Belladonna smirked, and her attention fell over him so heavily that Nicholas felt as though he'd gained another shadow.
"Everyone present knows of my origins. It's not necessary to reiterate them to prove some mysterious point. We've come because we wish for information," Nicholas said finally. "Is that so?"
"We're looking for what the last common year is," Sophia explained. "To find someone orphaned by the shift, which I'm sure you are well aware of."
The Belladonna leaned forward, resting her arms against the desk. A quill fluttered in its cup, and two grapes escaped their plate to find freedom on the floor. She stroked the veil covering her mouth, the way a man would stroke a beard.
"Indeed. That is certainly within my knowledge. Who is this person you seek?"
"It's Hen," Sophia began, but Nicholas gave a curt shake of the head. He would rather not have the woman turn her eye onto Etta. The darkness of this place, the way it seemed alive with its own curiosity, made him want to protect her from this stranger's interest for as long as possible.
The older woman turned her gaze back toward Nicholas. The small silver bell sewn into her massive hair tinkled.
"Well," the Belladonna continued, "your desperation reeks worse than your intriguing stench. You are clearly without earthly possessions, and neither of you was close enough to Ironwood to have new, useful secrets to trade. So perhaps our business has concluded before it began."
Sophia took a furious step forward, reaching for whatever sharp weapon she had strapped to her belt. The wolf jumped to its feet, baring its teeth as the girl came toward her. But Sophia growled back, glaring at the animal until its lips relaxed and its ears rose to their usual position. Nicholas's heart began to beat back against the thoughts of no running through his mind. They had not traveled through centuries of swamps and storms to arrive at a denial. This search could be simple. They wouldn't have to chase down every passage in every century for a lead on Etta's whereabouts.
"Is there nothing else you want in exchange from us?"
In the silence, an idea seemed to shape itself from candlelight and shadow. Nicholas noted the moment it struck the Belladonna, how her hands laced together and her veil shifted, as if masking a smile.
"Many of my auctions are for items that are priceless. They defy valuation. As you may know, I select winning bids based on what they can offer me. A secret, or a favor they're willing to do. Here, we can negotiate. In exchange for the information you seek, I'll ask for a favor," the Belladonna said, her chair creaking as she leaned back. "It will be of my choosing, to be completed sometime in the future."
"I won't do anything,"
Nicholas struggled to find the right words.
"Scandalous. Immoral."
One eyebrow rose.
"Goodness, what an imagination you have. By a favor, I mean a task. Perhaps to find and retrieve something for me. Carry a message. Assist in my own travel. And so on."
That did not sound entirely intolerable to him. "So he has to serve you?" Sophia demanded. "No questions asked?"
"For a time, only insofar as it pertains to the task," the Belladonna said, flicking her long nails at the girl.
"Slavery,"
he said, the dull burn inside of his chest growing. Intolerable. He should have guessed this underhanded business of hers would strive to bind the wings of his soul.
"Nothing so foul," the Belladonna said,
her voice sharp with offense.
"It's indentured servitude, and only a day or two's worth. Your task pays off your debt to me. once our business is concluded, that bond will be broken.
Sophia grabbed his collar, yanking him down to her height and startling him out of his tangle of thoughts.
Forget this. We'll try the jacarandas instead, like we planned.
And risk them not knowing? Risk running in circles long enough for this starting point to disappear? They'd failed to master time on this search, and now it was threatening to best them. Etta was hurt and alone, and the thought of taking a moment longer to debate this was intolerable. If anything, it was Sophia's infernal pride speaking for her again. Her entitlement. Nicholas hadn't expected the answers to be handed to them. This was a business deal, and he had to believe that Rose Linden wouldn't send him into the jaws of a literal and figurative wolf. The woman's methods were patently ridiculous, but she was still his ally.
"Everyone has a master, whether you realize this or not," the Belladonna said. "Luckily, I am a benevolent one. Mostly."
How very bitter that truth was when swallowed. Some were bound by loyalty and vows, others by an obsession with wealth, and others were owned by other men through no fault of their own. There was something else that Hall used to say, that life itself was uncertainty, and the only remedy to its madness was to act boldly. This was a risk, yes, but it was tied to a tantalizing reward. At least this was presented as a choice. At least he was retaining some measure of free will. Nicholas could tolerate this debt, so long as he felt the information he would be receiving was proportional to the work.
"There's no we," Nicholas told Sophia, detangling her fingers. "This is the answer."
Find Etta, salvage her future, fix those things he'd ruined. And to one day live a life of his own making, be left to his own ends, whatever shape that might take now.
"You won't say what the task will be before we agree."
The Belladonna's eyes narrowed, glancing toward a grandfather clock behind him.
"I haven't yet decided, but you've 30 seconds to agree before the offer is rescinded and Celine escorts you out."
She reached over and used one of her grotesque nails to tap the lip of the jar containing the thin silver weapon, marking the seconds. Nicholas's instincts were murmuring in displeasure about the lack of time to weigh the costs of this. Perhaps if he could make the deal more tolerable, sweeter, he could find that boldness that good faith required.
"I have a single condition," he said,
meeting the Belladonna's feline gaze.
"Before I agree, I would like you to answer a different question first."
"Are you in league with the devil?" He shoved the thought aside. "Will you devour my soul like a tart?" The Belladonna snorted, puncturing the silence that followed.
"Yes. All right. Are the thorns still in possession of the much-sought-after astrolabe, the one that used to belong to the Lindens?"
Nicholas tried to be as specific as possible, so she could not twist her answer, or tell him the fate of a different astrolabe. After a moment, with obvious reluctance, she said,
"In the last report I received, yes, a thorn was still in the possession of the astrolabe."
Her veil ruffled as she took in a breath, sucking it against her lips.
"Earlier you mentioned the jacarandas. I do not suppose you mean Remus and the Fitzhugh, the traitors."
Sophia glanced over at Nicholas before asking, "So what if I did?"
"If you are hoping to find the thorns, the group's last known location was in San Francisco in 1906. They appear to be on the move, however," she added. "And I'm not entirely certain of where they'll settle next. And if I am not certain, those two toadstools have no hope of knowing either."
Nicholas's brows rose. That was more information than he ever could have prayed for. He dared to test the limits of his luck by asking,
"Do the thorns have other times they frequent?" "They do, but I'm certain they are investigating the changes to the timeline, and will not be returning to any of those periods at present."
Nicholas felt the knotted muscles in his shoulder ease. He gave her a curt nod of thanks, feeling more secure in his decision to proceed now. The metal desk creaked as the Belladonna leaned her weight onto it. But before she could speak, Celine let out a sharp whine. A warning. Through the wall to his right, Nicholas could have sworn he heard voices shouting the word, "Revoluzia!" in the instant before the room blurred like fogged-over glass and began shaking violently. Thunder stole through the air, deafening and absolute. The jars and display cases rattled, heaps of glass smashing into each other as whole shelves collapsed. Sophia stumbled hard into the edge of the desk with a startled cry. Nicholas jerked backward, but caught himself in time to avoid the section of ceiling plaster that smashed near his feet.
"What the devil was that?"
he demanded. "A mortar strike?" More voices now.
"Za Revoluzia!"
The Belladonna shook the dust from her hair and gown, not unlike Celine, and began to sniff inquisitively at the air. Satisfied with what she'd discovered, she glanced at the small silver watch pinned to her hip.
"Calm yourself, beastie. This room has withstood any number of revolutions and riots. The only entrance is the passage. We are quite secure."
There were only a few moments of silence before the sound of heavy footfalls seeped through the walls, slashed through by the steady, racing sounds of shouts and gunfire. Voices were muddied, in a language she couldn't speak.
"Ashistitz vorets!"
The Belladonna rose, her gaze sweeping around the room, breath hissing from her. She stooped to pick a small silver bell and rang it. The longer it went without answer, the harder she rang it, until finally she heaved it at the passage. The young boy ducked as he entered, just missing a dead-on strike to the head.
"Clean up this mess," she told him, "and take an account of anything beyond repair."
The boy was sensible enough to wait until the woman looked away before sticking out his tongue.
"That's another year you owe me," she told him
without taking her eyes off her desk.
"Such ingratitude, and after I rescued you from my brother."
The already pale child turned the shade of chalk. With a nod, he went back to the passage, setting off its usual thunderous roar, and returned a moment later with a broom and pan.
"Now, where were we?"
the Belladonna said pleasantly, ignoring the irritated sweeps of the boy.
"Oh, dear."
She picked up one of the skulls that had fallen from the netting, stroking the curve of its empty eye sockets lovingly.
"I was rather fond of her. She used to bring me daffodils."
"That was the timeline," Sophia interrupted, her voice hollow. "It shifted again." "Because someone used the astrolabe, or..." Nicholas had never experienced the sensation of time aligning from one version to a new one. By the time he'd begun to travel with Julian, it had settled into some stability under Ironwood's rule. But the woman had mentioned revolutions, riots, implying that one might very well be happening outside of these walls. Could it be that the explosion they'd felt had been the actual cause of the change, and not someone acting in an earlier year? Which meant... what exactly for Essa?
"We weren't orphaned," he said slowly,
trying to reason this out on his own.
"Are we in the last common year, then? Was that the change itself, and not just a ripple?"
"Yes. But if that's your attempt to get me to reveal our year and location, you will be sadly disappointed," the Belladonna said. "I shall neither confirm nor deny we are in a year after both of your birth years."
Meaning, by her sad attempt at a wink, they were.
"A change this large could impact the information we've discussed as part of the deal," Nicholas said. "To locate the person in question, we'd need to know this year as well as the prior change, to ascertain if she's been orphaned again to this very year."
The Belladonna's jaw worked back and forth beneath her veil, eyes flashing.
"All right, beastie. I suppose it's a time to move this shop again anyway. But no, my dear child. that you have asked and received more of me than any man. I will not be pressed further.
Understood. The transaction, then,
Nicholas said, trying to clear the dust from his mouth and throat before he swallowed it.
How do we complete it?
Nicholas had noticed in passing that she wore an abundance of gold and silver rings on each of her fingers. They stacked up past her knuckles, some as thin as veins, some seemingly as thick as the finger itself. Now the Belladonna drew one off her ring finger and rose on creaking bones, shuffling through the fallen plaster and glass to the other side of the desk, carrying the whole room forward with her. Nicholas took the small gold band from her, surprised to find it so cold after being on her finger. Under her gaze, he slid it onto the ring finger of his right hand, and waited. Not a permanent mark on his flesh, thank God, for he'd enough scars for a dozen men, but a sign of ownership all the same, however temporary. Something inside of his heart began to sound in warning, like a ship's bell at the edge of a storm. No. I have come this far, and there is still too much ahead to stop now.
Our agreement is thus. A favor of my choosing for information on the last common year under the thorns, the Belladonna said. I swear to abide by our agreement, for my life will be forfeit. That is my vow. Repeat it.
He did, and no sooner did the word vow leave his lips than the ring seemed to flare with heat, tightening around his skin. Nicholas took a generous step back as he pulled away from the woman's claw-like grip. Not wanting to alarm Sophia, he clasped his hands behind his back and attempted to pull the damned thing off, or at least twist it to relieve the sudden pressure. It did not move. Celine retrieved her bone once more, her teeth clacking against its battered form. The Belladonna returned to her seat, sinking slowly into it. Sophia leaned both hands onto the desk and said,
"Let's have it, then."
The Belladonna's veil rustled again. How someone so old could have the laugh of a young girl, he would never know. Horror was a beast of a thing. It devoured everything it encountered. Hope, faith, expectation. Nicholas felt a chill stinging along his spine.
"Ma'am,"
he began, forcing his voice steady.
"Sweet beastie," she said. "For all of your talk, for all of your thinking you were clever enough to weigh this deal in your favor, it never once occurred to you to specify that I needed to provide the information before you completed my favor. The future, of course, can mean the centuries or seconds, minutes or hours."
Nicholas gripped the edge of the desk so tightly he heard his own knuckles crack.
"That is dishonorable. Unconscionable."
Sophia was more plain-spoken.
"You deceitful witch."
The Belladonna's eyes were so harrowing they nearly sent Nicholas's soul retreating from his body.
"Such a thing to say."
"That is outrageous," Sophia hissed. "They stole it from me. They beat me to take it. They left me with—"
She pressed the heel of her hand against her eye patch and swore again, spinning away, stalking back toward the passage.
"Hardly a tragic tale," the Belladonna called after her. "When it has created the woman you are now, you'll be of great help to him in this task. One eye will be enough."
Sophia stopped just for a moment, her posture rigid.
"I don't need any eyes to tear you to shreds."
"You made it sound as though you weren't entirely certain what you would ask of me,"
Nicholas managed to get out between gritted teeth. "A deal is a deal. He never, not for one solitary moment, would have agreed to this favor had he known it would eat up the one currency he didn't have. Time.
"I've only just decided you were right for this particular one. It should not take you long, provided you are as industrious as I've heard."
Another faint stirring at his core. He squared his shoulders, meeting her delighted gaze.
"It's quite simple, really," the Belladonna said. "I would like for you to kill Cyrus Ironwood."
Russia, 1919. 11. It occurred to Etta that perhaps the passage itself wasn't cold. It was simply breathing out the frosty air of what lay on the other side of it. She opened one eye slowly, half amazed by the fact that she was still vertical. The passage had tossed them out at alarming speed, after seeming to spin them head over heels. But she'd landed. Landed solidly, as if she'd taken the jump out of it herself.
"There you are," a voice said over the rattling moan of the passage.
There was a slight pressure on her wrist, and the shallow daze ripped away, jolting her back into the moment. Etta forced herself to take smaller breaths, sipping at the freezing air, cooling her lungs and pounding temples. At their backs, a wave of pressure burst from the passage, and she didn't need to turn to know that the last two guards had finally come through it. Etta swung her gaze around. When she traveled with Nicholas, she'd learned quickly enough that survival meant assessing her surroundings, determining the year, and figuring out how best to blend into the scenery. The lance of panic that went through her dissipated as her mind caught up to her instincts. They had taken a passage on Russian Hill in San Francisco, to Russia itself, which struck her as too big of a coincidence to be an actual coincidence. Her mind would never truly accept this, how her heels could be crunching through loose gravel one moment, then sinking into the soft earth of a forest in the next. But trees sheltered them from all sides. Their leaves shot through with fiery shades of red and gold. And the silence of this place made it feel more like a memory she rediscovered than a moment. To her left, jutting out of the glassy surface of the crawling river, was a rock formation that looked like something out of a dark kingdom, its jagged height like the remnant of a small watchtower. That same dark stone had been used to construct the breathtaking bridge that rose high over the water in an almost perfect arc. Its spine looked as thin as a finger from her vantage point, the way it was settled into the earth, becoming part of the mass of life around it, made her wonder if it wasn't just old, but ancient. What struck her most, what held her there in disbelief of its beauty, as the thorns milled around, was the way the late afternoon light reflected the image of the bridge into the water below.
"A perfect circle," Henry said from beside her. "Two halves meeting, for a time, as a whole."
Etta's brows furrowed at that show of romanticism, but Henry had already directed his attention to a pinch-faced Winifred, who was working her way through the mass of assembled guards. She'd changed into a fur coat, and a hat that looked like some sort of enormous, exotic flower was about to eat her face.
"Sir, all of the preparations have been made," she said. "He's expecting you for dinner this evening."
"He?" Etta asked, though she knew it was useless. Winifred's eyes flicked over at Etta, at Henry's coat still wrapped around her shoulders.
"I've procured a gown for her, if you'd like her to dine with you."
"Excellent," Henry said.
"We'll stop by the other's hotel so that we can both change. I'm assuming you found an appropriate suit for me as well."
"Of course," Winifred said. "It was the very first thing we did after we confirmed the alterations had taken hold."
"Any word from Kadir?"
"The missing thorn." Etta's focus sharpened on the woman's face, searching. But Winifred shook her head, clearly troubled.
"It's likely he's safe in the palace, and waiting for us to arrive."
"Why, Aunt, that almost sounded optimistic,"
Henry said with a knowing look to Etta.
"Otherwise," the woman finished, "he's dead and will only be in time to collect his remains."
"There it is," Jenkins murmured nearby. "Can always count on her to douse the light of hope."
Henry held out his arm to Etta, and once she'd taken it, they made their way toward the rough path that edged out from below the overgrowth of trees and bushes. Two of the guards jumped into place in front of him, leading the way. Etta found her feet naturally sinking into the footprints that already marked up the trail. While not all of the Thorns had left San Francisco, an even dozen had gone ahead to make preparations for Henry's arrival. Julian, to her surprise, had been escorted out with them. She'd caught sight of him being half-dragged onto the street, trying to hide the decanter of brandy inside his coat. "Where are we going?" she asked. He glanced at her.
"I hope you don't mind, but it's a surprise. Oh no, I promise, it's a welcome one. I simply want to see... I'd like to introduce you to a friend of mine, and an important place to my side of the family."
A parent who shared with their child. What a novel concept. As long as it doesn't involve tigers, or cobras.
"Pardon?" he said, startled.
Winifred swept into the conversation with her usual awareness and tact.
"Far be it from me to tell you what to do, Henry. But I worry. The girl has hardly been trained, and the stakes of this dinner will be so high. Let me at least work with her for a few days."
"There are no stakes. It is simply dinner with a friend," Henry said. "I need you to take charge of searching the various rooms for Kadir and the astrolabe."
The world darkened around them as the trees closed ranks over their heads, and the sun continued its downward slide. "What happens if he and the astrolabe aren't here?" Etta asked, her boots squelching loudly through the mud. "What then?"
"I haven't gotten past the prayer that he is here," Henry said. "I'm curious, though. What would you do in my position?"
"Do you care what I think?" Etta asked. He seemed confused by the question.
"Would I have asked otherwise? I want to know your thoughts."
Etta wanted to bask for a moment in the small, trembling warmth of that idea, but quickly stomped it down.
"The thoughts of a 17-year-old child," Winifred said. "Really, Henry?"
But he wanted to know, and was plainly waiting. It made her feel trusted. When in her life had her mother ever stopped to ask her about her thoughts or feelings on something, without having already made the decision herself? Even Nicholas had tried to take advantage of her trust, however half-hearted the attempt had been. He was overburdened with a guilty conscience, and was honorable in a way only the heroes of history and fiction seemed to be. "Immediately start sniffing around any ironwoods you can find," Etta said. "Set off more alterations, as many as you can manage at once." Henry inclined his head toward her, considering this.
"Ah, to lure Cyrus out with the astrolabe to fix them."
Etta nodded. "Even if he didn't bring it out into the open, you'd still split the ironwood's attention, meaning more chances to follow one of the ironwoods back to wherever he's taken up, and find the astrolabe there."
"Fortunately, we already have that information. He's bought back his old home in Manhattan, 18th century. We're having a damned time getting near to it with the British occupation, though."
He let out a thoughtful hum.
"I had considered using the ironwood yearling to lure him out to more open ground. We simply don't have the manpower for what you're describing, though it's an excellent strategy otherwise."
"An excellent thought," Winifred said, picking up her pace to keep up with their long strides. "He has never brought anything to us to merit the kindness we've shown him. He's a leech."
"That's not entirely true," Henry said, with a fond look at Etta.
"That was pure luck," Winifred groused.
"Well, it was certainly fortunate," he agreed. "What did you make of him, Etta?"
"Julian," she clarified, brushing a leaf from her hair.
"He's
a brat, obnoxious, high on himself, rude.
An ironwood."
"Was he untoward to you at all?" Henry asked carefully. "He's a shameless flirt, but I judged him to be fairly toothless. Many of the Thorns feel he's outstayed his welcome, and if it wasn't for the happy serendipity of finding you, I dare say I might agree."
"What do you mean, Julian's outstayed his welcome?" she asked.
"You've more questions than sense, child," Winifred muttered.
"He's no longer able to provide information about ironwoods that we don't already know," Henry said. Ironwood has taken a few of our travelers prisoner over the years, and I had considered trading Julian for them.
That's probably the thing he's most afraid of, Etta told Henry. Ironwood might actually kill him. A road emerged beyond the trees ahead of them. Within an instant of its appearance, streams of headlights swept over it, and two old-fashioned black cars rolled into place in front of the trees.
"You really think so?" Henry asked. "Everything is such a joke to him. I half expected his dalliance with us to be for amusement alone. Ironwood wouldn't kill his heir. Not when he needs him."
"The astrolabe could be used to create new heirs, if he uses it to save his wife," she pointed out.
"That was your mother's theory, yes," Henry said. "And a likely one."
Julian could have gone back to Ironwood at any point, especially when it became difficult to survive in hiding, she continued, working out her own thoughts on the matter. "Instead, he came to his grandfather's most hated enemy and betrayed him to you. He needed help, but he clearly felt like he needed protection, too. So I don't know if you should send him back to Ironwood, but you could at least use that same fear to get some last important details out of him that he might not give you otherwise." He nearly beamed at her. Etta again had to fight the ridiculous glow her heart gave in response.
"Second most hated," Henry said. "I dare say that honor belongs to your mother, and she'd skin me for taking that from her."
Winifred let out a loud harumph and released her hold on her nephew's arm, charging forward to the first of the cars. The driver barely had time to jump out and open the door for her.
"I might have a better use for him, if tonight turns out the way I imagine," Henry said as he wisely steered them toward the second car.
He nodded to that driver.
"Paul, how are the boys?"
Etta missed the man's answer as she ducked inside the car and slid across the seat. Henry joined her after a moment, removing his hat and gloves.
"All the logic of the Hemlocks without the ruthlessness of the Lindens," he said,
as he sat both on the stretch of leather between them. The car dipped as one of the guards sat in the front beside the driver.
"You'll do very well indeed."
As she settled into the warmth of the car and let it thaw her stiff skin, she passed his coat back to him. Henry folded it in his lap and turned his gaze out his window. Etta watched his face in its reflection, how easy humor and brightness vanished like a flame blown out. He seemed to retreat into himself, leaving a look of severe contemplation as he touched the rose she hadn't noticed he'd tucked into his lapel. And Etta could picture it so clearly then, how the reflection of the bridge had disappeared in the water, leaving one half to wait to see its other self again. The city dwelt in darkness. The roar of the engine swallowed every other sound from the world outside her window, those streets cloaked in the gray evening haze. Etta felt she was watching a kind of silent movie. As the car rolled down a huge main thoroughfare,
"Nevesky Prospect," Henry explained.
Etta had the sense they were slipping into St. Petersburg on the edge of someone's shadow, uninvited, unwanted. The light slush covering the ground was nearly indistinguishable from the sludge of garbage that lined the street's gutters. The car jumped as it rolled over something. Etta craned her neck back, but saw only the tattered remains of a banner and two poles that were being dragged away by men in stark military uniforms. Her gaze followed their path to a courtyard where a bonfire raged. The cloth and wood were fed into it behind a wall of soldiers standing shoulder to shoulder, backlit by the flames. A few men and women lingered at the fringes of its glow, but the car sped by too quickly for Etta to see what they were trying to do besides stay warm. The beautiful facades of the buildings that rolled by, with all of their glorious arches and domes, looked as though they'd been painted with jewels. It made the contrast of what was happening on the streets that much bleaker. Etta leaned back against her seat, resenting the thick white fur coat Winifred had stuffed her into. The truth was, she burned with the desire to be herself, to see more clearly the points at which she and Henry might intersect. But dressed so grandly, wearing another creature's skin, and still feeling the burn of Winifred's crash course on period etiquette, she felt the pressure to let Etta slip away, to disappear into this false image of a lady. Her dress was a thin, rose-pink silk sheath, cut straight and falling just above her ankles. The topmost layer was sheer, draping over her in scalloped tiers, each edged with the smallest bit of shimmering fringe. Before they left the venue, Henry had handed her a pair of white gloves that stopped just above her elbow, and a long strand of pearls, and had given Winifred some sort of diamond, hopefully crystal, barrette, to affix in Etta's hair. After an hour-long struggle, the woman, with the help of two other maids, had managed to wrestle Etta's hair into something resembling finger waves, pinning the length of it up and under like a false bob. She'd be lucky not to find bald patches later that night, when she finally got to take the pins out. Etta wrung her hands in her lap, glancing around, at the driver, at Jenkins in the front passenger seat, at Henry. He had his gold pocket watch open again, but quickly snapped it shut. Etta caught a glimpse of the time. 7-something. Way too early for there to be no other cars or carriages out on the streets, besides the ones that were parked, or those that looked more like tanks, clearly military. Here and there a few scattered people moved by, ducking into shops or making their way home. It reminded her of the short time that she and Nicholas had spent in London during the Blitz. This scene had all the uneasiness of the last dying leaf on a branch, waiting to fall. "Are we in the 1920s?" Etta asked, turning to look at Henry again. It was an obvious guess based on the cars, style of dress, and small touches of decor in the hotel. He, however, had turned his head to look up at something the car was racing past. Flagpoles?
1919, Jenkins offered, turning to speak to her through the partition. I thought the reforms had been passed, Henry said, with an edge of anger.
Jenkins and the other guard seemed equally startled by it.
Why does the city look this way?
They've already broken from the original timeline, Etta realized. In some way, big or small, the timeline had altered enough that Henry no longer fully recognized some of the parts in the century's great machine.
Some socialist leader was imprisoned, caught red-handed in an assassination attempt on the Minister of the Interior, Jenkins explained. A small alteration, not nearly enough to cause a ripple, only a headache for our preparations. Rumor has it there are some of the old Bolsheviks out working people up about it, hence the military presence. Give it a day and it'll pass. Bolsheviks, Henry muttered, pressing a hand to his forehead. Or Ironwoods.
A single drop of sweat worked its way down the ridges of Etta's spine. "This isn't the St. Petersburg you knew," she pressed. "You seem surprised by the state of the city."
"It's called Petrograd in this area,"
he corrected with his usual gentleness.
"I am surprised to see the state of it, knowing the reforms to improve lives across the country had passed. Whatever messes have been made, we'll clean them up while we're here."
The first tap against her window sounded like a rock kicked up from the road. It was the second hit that made her turn, just as a man launched himself out of the darkness of an alley and leaped over the sidewalk. His arm craned back like a pitcher's, and Etta gasped, instinctively cringing as a bottle hurtled toward the car, smashing against her window. Another man, a woman, more, surged out from the city's cracks and crevices.
"Faster!"
Henry barked, reaching into his jacket for a pistol.
"Trying!"
the driver barked right back. Another stone flew toward the web of cracks in her window. But she refused to be pulled down, to have her face pressed against the seat until she was nearly smothered by leather and flickering fear. Clattering, shattering, smashing. The whole car rocked with each hit. Etta searched the buildings around them for more protesters. Up high, on top of a bakery, 2 cloaked shadows moved. As impossible as it was with the distance between the buildings, they seemed to easily make the flying leaps to keep pace with the car. There was a flash of silver, like a blade. Or a gun. This time she yanked Henry back down with her as a gunshot, 2, shattered her window, blowing shards of glass inside, over her head, along her back. Etta's whole body jumped at each blast, one hand pinned beneath her, the other rising to cover her right ear. The men up front were slinging words and orders to each other over her head. Etta fought to breathe, to sit up again, but the heavy weight of Henry's arm kept her down, until finally the shouting outside became muffled. The car wheezed and shuddered, but began to cruise faster. She stayed in that same awkward position for the next 10 minutes, until she felt the wheels of the car begin to slow. Henry released her, still swearing beneath his breath. Etta sat straight up, her vision black and spotty. She brushed small, sparkling pieces of glass from her coat and hair, watching, stunned, as they collected in her hand and lap like ice.
"Are you all right?"
Etta hadn't realized Henry was speaking to her until he gripped her shoulder, almost to the point of pain, and turned her toward him to begin inspecting her. There was a small cut above his left brow, but he seemed otherwise fine.
"My God," he was saying. "I'll kill them myself."
"I'm fine. I'm fine," Etta insisted. A cold wind blew up the back of her exposed neck through the opening in her window. "What was that all about?"
"Protesters," Jenkins said. "Damn it all. We should never have taken Vesky Prospect. But the palace assured us it would be safe. Sir, believe me."
"The people on the roof," she tried to say. Henry held up his hand, still breathing hard as the car rolled through a gate, and came to a slow, shuddering stop. Several figures in suits and nondescript uniforms flowed out of a nearby building's arched entryway. With a start, Etta opened the door and let herself out on unsteady feet, the glass spilling out around her feet, disappearing into the light smattering of snow. Her breath heated the air milk-white as she slowly tipped her face up. They'd arrived at a building that was beyond imposing. Ornate couldn't begin to capture its presence. It was almost Baroque, the way the pale green facade was trimmed with gold. The building itself was massive, stretching on as far as her eyes could see in both directions. Statues of women and saints watched from the roof above, dusted with the same sooty snow. It had to be the palace. The second car, with Winifred, Julian, and another guard, zipped up behind them a moment later, skidding to a stop in a similar state of disarray. Winifred all but rode out of the automobile on a wave of her own fury, bellowing, "Those beasts!" Julian was close behind, looking far less angry and far grayer in the face. He raised his brows in Etta's direction. "Bumpy ride," he mouthed. Etta's brow creased as she looked away, back toward Henry, who had deigned to let Jenkins brush the remaining pieces of glass from his coat. Then an elderly man was at her side, clucking and cooing at her, bowing in a way that made Etta take a startled step back. The Russian came too fast and furious for her to find the three words in the language she actually knew. The whirling activity seemed to still somewhat as Henry stepped up behind her and followed her gaze upward. His face softened, the stern line of his mouth relaxing, as if seeing an old friend.
"Welcome," he said, "to the Winter Palace."
Unknown. Unknown. 12. Nicholas could not find the words to ask the woman to repeat herself, but she did it regardless, that same girlish laughter riding the ends of her words. "Dare I ask the obvious question," Sophia said, oddly calm. "Of why?"
"It's not your place to ask questions," the Belladonna said, never taking her eyes off Nicholas. "Only to obey, if you value your life, that is."
Nicholas's feet were rooted to the floor, but he felt his soul release and swing about the room, banging at the walls. In his life, he'd been made to feel the burn of humiliation and impotent rage many times, in many ways, by the world. But this? Unyielding anger choked him now. If he could have compelled himself to move, he would have slammed his fist against her great metal desk until he cracked it. Around his neck, the thin leather cord that held at his earring fell like a wreath of bricks.
"What do you mean by that?" Sophia demanded. "Stop talking in riddles!"
She stormed forward, only to be brought up short by Celine. And still, the Belladonna was watching him, waiting for him.
"You,"
he began, when his mind began to work again.
"You expect me to kill my own kin. Can you begin to fathom what you're asking of me?"
He couldn't kill Ironwood. Desire and rational thought were at odds. Of course he'd dreamt of it 1,000 times by 1,000 different means, and woken less satisfied than he might have imagined, considering the tortures to which the man had subjected every person Nicholas loved. But when it was all distilled down, the torment, the fury, the desperation, the truth of the matter was laid bare. Killing the old man would stain his soul and irrevocably bind them together, until Nicholas met his own reward and was forced to answer for it. It was one thing to do violence in self-defense, but this was murder, assassination. The thought alone left a taste like rust in his mouth.
"It's a him, or yourself," the Belladonna said.
She snapped her fingers, and the boy stopped pretending to sweep the same pile of glass and dried-out insects while eavesdropping. Nicholas turned just as he scampered back through the passage.
"You'll come to find that I am the only one who can remove that ring, and the longer it stays on your finger, the more the poison inlaid in it will sap your strength."
"I'll cut it off, then. Cut the whole bloody hand off if I have to," he told her,
reaching for the knife at his belt.
"Do it," she encouraged.
"In the fact, you may as well cut your wrists. Your weakened body will only absorb the poison more quickly. But of course, you're welcome to test the theory. It just strikes me that there's someone you wish to find first."
She knows of Etta's existence. His blood seemed to turn to bile. The wave of nausea stole over him so quickly, he was sure he was not going to be able to stay upright. She knows of Etta. Which? Which? The illusions, the deceit, the cunning. And now, poison.
"Come now," she said. "Would it be so terrible? Have you forgotten that he kept you as property? That you are the issue of a vile man who forced himself upon a helpless woman? That he sold your mother to a man in Georgia who used her, who beat her, until the sickness finally freed her?"
Nicholas pressed a fist against his mouth, and would have turned his back to her to collect himself, had he trusted her not to stick a dagger through his back.
"He resides in the old house of your childhood," she said. "You haven't much time. He travels soon. I imagine I will see you back here soon as well."
"Madam," he said, "I will see you in hell."
There was a tugging on his arm, and he did not realize he was moving toward the passage until Sophia dug her nails through his shirt, into his skin.
"Don't look back at her," she muttered. "Don't give her that."
He did not. He held his breath as they stepped through the passage, and then released his scream into its thunder. The smell of the air changed as they emerged on the other side. That same stench of wet earth her clothing seemed to breathe out as she moved.
"Carter! Wait! Damn!"
She had to catch his arm to stop his path, swinging him around to prompt his gaze. Nicholas had the oddest feeling that he was back on his deathbed, a fever racking his brain. There was a haze about her, an unreal quality. Fool. Bloody fool. Christ. Rose Linden had led him like a lamb to the slaughter, but he'd only himself to blame. He'd been rash, hadn't thought his calculations through, and now he was... A slap across the face snapped his head to the left. Sophia raised her hand again, prepared to issue another blow.
"You look like you're going to pass out," she explained. "And you're too bloody big for me to drag you."
"Thank you. My apologies. My... thanks."
He had no idea what he meant to say. but the hit had blown the dust off an old thought, one he hadn't dared to court in years. Kill the old man and be free. Of vows, of guilt, of this unbearable heaviness anchoring his heart to his guts. No, he'd sold his soul, but he wasn't about to damn it. He held his hands to his face, trying to smother the bellow that tore out of him. The gold ring pressed a hot kiss to his cheek. Nicholas tried to yank it off again, with no luck. He needed to find Etta. He wanted to find Etta. There was only Etta. "Forget what that old bat said," Sophia said fiercely, her voice ringing like steel. "She doesn't have a hold on you. She only wants you to think she does. Show her you're above it. Show her you aren't afraid, damn it."
"Are you saying that because you believe it?"
he asked bitterly.
"Or because you need Ironwood alive, so you can bring the astrolabe back to him?"
Sophia recoiled. It had been some time since he was on the receiving end of her murderous glare, and he was almost comforted by its familiarity. "You think I won't gut that man the first chance I get?"
"I think you're in this for your own ends," he told her. "I think a rather large part of you, the very same part that prevented you for years from lowering yourself into even conversation with me, loves seeing me bested by circumstances."
"Of course I'm in it to serve myself, you fool, and so are you," she hissed. "We've derailed our search for the one thing that matters to find someone who ultimately really doesn't. But if you think I'd go back to the same family that wanted me just about as much as they wanted you, then you need to pull your head out of your ass before I do it for you." Orphanage. Pickpocketing. The past she'd kept hidden beneath the layers of silk and lace. She had worked hard to polish herself into something shining, gleaming. And what had it gotten her? Not the heir, or even being named it once the heir was gone. "As if he would ever let either of us truly forget our origins," he thought with a pang. Anger, however, was easier to live inside than unwelcome sympathy.
"Isn't that why you kept the blade hidden? Because you intended to use it?"
Her eyebrows flew up. "Is that what this is about? Yes, I picked that blade up when we were in Nassau. I might have told you about it, except I knew you wouldn't believe I hadn't had it on me the entire time. I just wanted to be able to study it without you snatching it away like I'm a child."
"You should have told me," he insisted.
"Because you've shown me so much trust. You've listened to me so well, such as 10 bloody minutes ago when I told you not to take that deal," she said, throwing a finger in his face. "But you did take it, and now we have to live with it. So stop making that pitiful face and buck up. We'll go to Carthage, all right? Ironwood sends out notices about major changes to the timeline to all of the guardians and travelers posted throughout the centuries. By the time we arrive, the 2 jacarandas will likely have the answer we need. Or they can point us to someone who can tell us. Rose Linden can go take a long walk off a cliff and drag the Belladonna to hell with her." She'd mauled him with the truth. He had not, in fact, trusted her, not even for a moment, because he'd been so certain she hadn't given him a reason to. They could not continue this way, but they could not seem to break out of this cycle of loathing either.
"She said it'd be useless to talk to the jacarandas."
"And you believe her, after the trick she pulled?" Sophia pressed. "She told us all that nonsense about the thorns to get us to trust her enough not to question the terms of the deal. Forget her. I'd rather travel to Carthage on a chance than believe her ever again." She was right. If nothing else, they needed to leave this infernal place. Nicholas straightened, cracking his knuckles at his side to try to release the pressure that seemed ready to shoot from his hands. "This is shameful. I'm falling apart like a boy during his first boarding. Pull yourself together, man." Nicholas passed through the alchemy workshop at a near run, and took the stairs 2 at a time. Sophia kept pace with him, plundering the depths of her extensive knowledge of profanities as she misjudged the distance of a step and fell forward, catching herself on her hands. She sprang up the last few steps, nearly spitting on Nicholas's offered hand. "I don't need your bloody help."
"Then you won't have it,"
he shot back. The golden-haired boy didn't look up from his book as they passed. With a chill that sank into his bones, Nicholas realized